Welcome to 167 Hours Beyond Sunday, a companion podcast to the sermons of Crossroads Christian Church in Gray, Tennessee, where we try to go beyond the message and talk about what life looks like in the 167 hours we're not in church a week. I'm your host, my name's Ryan Evans, and today I'm joined by our Connect Minister, Patrick Mitchell. How are you doing today, sir?
Better than I deserve, Ryan. Thank you for having me on the podcast, and I want to say a special thank you to you putting in the extra time and energy to make this resource available. It was a fantastic idea, and you've done a great job pulling it off so far, so thank you.
Well, thank you. I'll give you the $20 I owe you for the compliment.
Gracias.
You know, so there's nothing quite like starting full-time work at a church right before a pandemic starts. So what's that been like for you, man? That's got to be weird.
Fantastic. It was definitely not as I imagined coming in, you know, to Crossroads. But the crazy thing was, like, just as I felt like I was starting to recognize people and faces and names, you know, it just all vanished.
And, I'm sure,
you know, I think the bright side to it is that in the time since we've regathered, I've gotten to know fewer people, but better. So rather than trying to keep up with 500 people showing up on a weekend, I'm getting to know, especially the Connect team, you know, our greeters and hosts and ushers and cleanup crew, getting to know them better. And so feeling like, you know, forging some good relationships there that hopefully we get to build on moving forward.
There's nothing quite like when you first get to a place and you're trying to nail down everyone's names. I mean, in youth group, you know, I've got about 30 to 50 kids I've got to really remember that are going to be there consistently.
Yeah.
And it takes a while, you know? And then every crop of seventh graders, it's like it takes me about 3 to 4 weeks to really start to nail them. I actually have a trick that I use with kids, though. I don't think it'd work with adults.
All right.
As if I forget their names, I start to, like, give them prizes. So I'll say, all right, next week, if I don't remember your name, you get a candy bar.
Yeah.
Which creates this weird psychological where they actually want me to forget their name.
Right.
So it's a win-win scenario for me. So either I forget their name and they get a candy bar so they're happy, or I remember their name and they feel valued.
Yeah. I feel like Oprah Winfrey could do that. Like at church, like, if I forget your name, you get an iPad.
There you go.
You get an iPad. Everyone gets an iPad. But no, it's been pretty good. I think it's been cool too, just seeing the staff, you know, pitch in together and have people step in where their gifts and aptitudes are. Just good cohesion, you know, I'd say. So,
well, I'm sure, like, from a learning your team standpoint, you get to see everyone in crisis almost immediately. So
100%. Yes. Yeah. It's like, oh, look, and everybody panic.
So outside of preaching, I'm sure there's still a good part of the church that's kind of getting to know you. So could you tell us a little bit about you, your family, and maybe why you came to Crossroads?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I grew up in Knoxville, so not too far from UT's campus, and thought I would go to UT, actually enrolled at UT. And after spending a night there for something, I think it was orientation, I was just like, nope, not doing it.
So you weren't, like, on campus as a student yet?
We were just a couple months away from starting.
Okay.
And I
would, well,
like, I was doing scheduling and all that stuff, and then was just, you know, said there's no way I'm going to get swallowed whole here. So I had a friend that had gone to Milligan and, had visited one time, and I actually emailed the then tennis coach, whose name was Rich Aubrey. Maybe some of our church people have heard of that guy, one of our elders. And I said, hey, coach, I'd love to play tennis there if possible. And that's how I ended up at Milligan. So met my wife, Lindsay, there. And we have four kids. We've got one boy, three girls. They are ages 9, 7, 6, and 4. So, I mean, I look at my wife and she gets pregnant. It's just what happened. So, but we're done. We're done. We're good with four. And we actually have one in heaven. Had a miscarriage in there. That's just part of our story. And,
But thank you for saying that, by the way. Yeah. I don't, you know, it wasn't until my wife and I were trying to get pregnant that people really started telling us about how difficult that process is.
Yeah.
Because it's not as easy for everyone to look at their wife and get pregnant. Plus,
right,
there are those losses that a lot of people don't talk about.
No.
Which is trauma.
It is. And I didn't even think for Lindsay, she's talked about the fact that, you know, there was never really time to grieve in that. But once that happens, it's like this sorority of women just come out of the woodworks and you're like, whoa, you have no idea how much that is a part of people's story.
It's so normal and we don't realize it.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
Both our parents, we didn't know this, you know, we were like,
right.
And they, you know, everyone, it's so interesting. I didn't mean to get sidetracked off on that,
no,
but it's still, it's a cool thing.
That's an important word. And I can just imagine too, in this season, how, you know, the whole trying to start a family or what that's looking like recovering from that kind of loss in the midst of COVID is just even more difficult.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that there's a lot of love going out to folks listening. So then as far as like the church world, I'm married into the Christian church. Milligan was really the first Christian church experience I had. I grew up Baptist.
All right.
You know, so I went to a strong church in Knoxville and my wife's from Savannah. And so everything and everyone I really know within the church world came from Savannah Christian, uh-huh. which is now Compassion Christian. Did an internship there and connections there took me to a job in California, outside of Los Angeles, which was awesome. And then from there, another connection, ministry in St. Louis, until we made our way back.
That's quite a culturally pretty varied, probably.
It really is.
St. Louis, California,
yeah.
and East Tennessee.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, plenty of time in Savannah. So yeah, from coast to coast, and I think it really made us, you know, both Southerners appreciate our culture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, things about it that we were like completely blind to because we'd always been in it. And then getting into other cultures and you hear all the caricatures of, you know, the left coast and, you know, how crazy liberal, you know, California. And I'm like, yeah, sure. There's some of that. But we were in a pocket of, you know, a lot of diversity and we just really appreciated that.
Yeah. But, and, you know, we could probably do an entire podcast episode about how culture affects faith. You know,
yeah, write that down.
Richard Rohr, Father Rohr,
yeah.
From Enneagram, connoisseur. You know, he always talks about the tricycle. Everyone's faith is made up by the three wheels, tradition, the church, and experience.
Yeah.
But not everyone's aware that experience is the front wheel. And if you don't realize that your experience has formed your faith, then you're functioning with a flat wheel, and it's really hard to grow.
Yeah, yeah. And even a step beyond that, how you interpret your experience.
Oh yeah.
Shapes. We're going off on some stuff here.
None of this was intentional, but really that could, it's such a sham that I brought that up.
Yeah.
To leave it.
Put it on the shelf. We're coming back. All right. So we made our way back to Tennessee into the Tri-Cities. I was doing some coursework at Emmanuel and started pastoring at Bunker Hill Christian Church in Bluff City, sister church, where actually Rita Boer, our lead minister's wife, a lot of her family is at Bunker Hill, so was already kind of connected through that. And I was also working in administration at Providence Academy, which is a school in town here. So, but man, why I come to Crossroads? I'd known about Crossroads, obviously, since Milligan. Actually did an internship with Kit Dotson in student ministry back when, like, 13 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it was brief because we ended up moving to Savannah and doing an internship there. But so I'd known about Crossroads forever. And honestly, it was just like when the time came up of coming back to the Tri-Cities again, I just knew there were a few churches I would consider working at, and Crossroads was on that short list, and the position of Connect Minister made sense. And I knew Curtis, had known him for a while. I knew Rich Aubrey, Kit Dotson, Phil Roberts. And I just honestly was like, you know what? If the church is crazy and, you know, a terrible place to be, I don't think those guys would be there. So I had this like sense of safety, just knowing some people here.
It's good to be here.
Kind
of like coming home to you both in the sense that you know the area, but there's also family.
Right.
There's people that you love and know and trust here.
Yeah. Yeah. And just felt like too, you know, more than ever with the way population is expanding here, moving towards Gray, you know, this church is just perfectly situated between Kingsport, Johnson City, you know, obviously Gray, and is just prime, really.
Potential is the word.
To reach
right?
people, yeah.
I mean, that's, I remember when I was getting hired on, that was the one thing I was like, this church has potential.
It's positioned, absolutely.
You know, it has the right stuff to get there, which is always exciting when you're coming into a place.
Yes.
So let's get into the sermon a little bit from this last Sunday. And I think one of the big concepts coming out of it was the word obedience. So what comes to mind when you hear the word obedience?
Yeah, I think as I was reflecting on this question, it's easy to lump obedience in and really think of it more in the negative mm-hmm. of disobedience.
Yeah.
Because we often think of whether it's our childhood or now that I have kids, obviously I start thinking of like trying to train my children in obedience.
I'm sure.
And you automatically think like, oh, this is how the Lord must feel looking at me and having much more appreciation for the work he has in front of him. But, you know, thinking about just training in obedience and, you know, the trust factor, you know, mm-hmm. which, you know, we'll get to, but, obedience, I guess, in our household, it just looks so different for the mm-hmm. different ages. And I think maybe there's something synonymous there with our different ages of faith and yeah. our maturity in faith and what that looks like. So for me, I look at trying to train, you know, let's say that obedience in picking up after yourself at home.
Yeah.
This is a constant, you know, I'm stepping on Legos. literally yesterday, Lindsay, I hear her scream and she had stepped on a marble. And, you know, it's just a marble, but when you're barefoot and it's on the carpet, yeah. it hurts. And so just this constant, like how often you have to go back to something before it becomes habitual, before it becomes something you don't even have to think about.
Yeah. I mean, that in and of itself, it's a good connection to probably how God feels about us, right?
Yes.
Like, yeah. how many times are we going to go through this before it finally clicks?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, if we take a look or a glimpse at the history of that the Bible illustrates, it shows pretty transparently that people have always had a hard time trusting God. The book yes. of Judges is just this cycle of sin and depravity and yep. rescue and sin and depravity and rescue. So why do you think for us as Christians, it is so hard for us to trust God?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, we can take obviously like the super divine, you know, angle and say, well, our perspective is limited.
Yeah.
God's is unlimited. You know, he sees, he knows. And I've heard the illustration once in a sermon of, it's kind of like if you're cleaning out a fish tank uh-huh. and you have to pick the fish up out of the water just for a moment, that fish doesn't know that actually what you're doing is for their good
yeah.
and for their survival. And I think that's probably how we feel, you know, sometimes like something's happening and here are these great big hands and we don't really know what's going on. Hmm. And so I think just our earthly, you know, limited perspective, can feel that way. And I was thinking about this in our earthly relationships. We gauge trust based on what someone is doing or saying, mm-hmm. and we kind of have an understanding of their motives. We can read in scripture that God's motives are for our good and for his glory, but we can't really see it.
Yeah.
And I think there is just that, I think it's the part where we just have to go, he knows we're human. You know, yeah. he understands, he knows we are going to have a hard time with that because we can't see everything he's trying to do. And we just, it feels like blind trust, you know, to have faith sometimes, but like the way I'm just reading Hebrews right now.
Yeah.
So the way Hebrews talks about like our faith being this assurance of things hoped for, a conviction of things unseen, it just feels so backwards. Like,
yeah.
how do I have a conviction of what's not seen?
Well, yeah, I don't like that, right? I want to know, please. Can
right.
you please tell me exactly, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. I need to be in charge. I need to know what's going on. I want to yeah. understand before I do anything.
Yeah, and there's no one else in our lives like that. Like,
yeah.
I don't look at my wife and be like, you have to trust me. No matter what I do or say, you have to trust me. She'll just look at me and be like, you're a fool. Like, yeah, by what you do and say, I will determine whether I trust you. And you know, God's just going, you're going to have to trust me
mm-hmm.
regardless of what happens. And we're supposed to go, okay. And, yeah. and that's hard. That is hard. It's again, that Hebrews 11, like all these people put their faith and their trust in the Lord and they didn't receive what they were promised this side of eternity.
Yeah.
You know, so it's part of it.
So to combine both the sermon series, what you just said, and a verse that Patrick Chella mentioned last week, don't expect this level of connection moving forward in the podcast, folks. You know, Patrick mentioned the verse, you know, the word is a lamp unto my feet, a light unto my path. Curtis once back, I can't remember, years ago, I think when I was in college, talked about how, you know, we want the Bible to function almost like a flashlight in our lives, that it's going to light up the path in front of us. We're going to know everything coming. We're going to see it all, and we're going to know everything and where we're going. But that's not what a lamp is. A lamp more just lights up the immediate area around you, and you have to hold on to it, because if you set it down and walk away, guess what? You're in the dark, you know. And I've always thought of that illustration every time I think of, you know, how when we interact with Scripture, that's how it is in our lives. It's not a flashlight. It's a step-by-step cling to it.
Yeah, I've never forget hearing Tommy Politz from Hillside Christian in Texas talk about that text and preach that and use that illustration. And it really has helped transform the way I think about Scripture, because I think for so long, my deepest desire was for certainty.
Yeah.
And that constant prayer we have for clarity. And it's really, and I had a counselor one time tell me, he's like, Patrick, your prayer for clarity is purely a lack of faith.
Yeah.
And I was like, do tell, you know? And it's just that, like, my desire for certainty is I'm just trying to control. I want to domesticate God and the Spirit and faith. And
it's a futile effort. Yeah. Certainty is a futile effort.
Like being a volunteer football fan is what it feels like. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and that's a, you and I talked the other day, the more we know, the less we know, you know, it's like the more you explore things. I mean, especially in our faith and especially in our understanding of God, if any human at any point declares so confidently that they understand God,
Yeah.
You arrogant little nothing.
I mean, and I used to, I gravitated towards that kind of preaching and writing. I think especially in my early and mid-20s. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you start exploring and reading and just really being open to what the Spirit would say. And, and, you know, I think this is coming up a lot. I think with this sermon series, you know, we've got a Life with God group, that's Zooming on Thursdays. And,
what time, just that, you know, there might be a listener here that doesn't know about that one. Make sure that they might have
that
a chance to join.
That is 7 PM. Yeah. If you're interested, shoot me an email, pmitchell@crossroadsgray.org. And, you know, not too late to hop in on that.
Yeah.
But just talking about, you know, we have to just be open to having our assumptions destroyed.
Yeah.
When we put ourselves before the living God of the living word.
Yeah.
Rather than trying to treat it as like this, you know, archaeological dig where it's just dead words on a page and we are the ones in control of the site. I think the more I've learned, the more I've read and studied, I am sure of, you know, less things. and I am kind of leery of folks that just feel like, no, I am absolutely, this is 100% how this is. And, I'm like, I'm sure of the divinity of Jesus, you know, the triune Lord, Godhead.
You preached recently, you know, unity in the essentials. And I think that's a constant that we have to, in the church and throughout the history of the church, remind ourselves is that there are essentials. And then there's a lot of stuff that's flipping complicated. You know, it's not super easy to understand. And there's a variety of perspectives and opinions.
Yes. And I think in that stretch and strain of studying and having conversations and learning from those that you disagree with, I think that's how we grow.
Yeah.
That's where we mature. And, you know, as long as we just dig our heels on something and, you know, that's not an essential, you know, unto salvation and refuse to really be open to the conversation or whatever, I think it reveals, you know, a certain amount of just like we should, you know, kind of the man in the mirror thing that Curtis talked about. We need to reflect and go, man, is there something here I'm not seeing, you know, that I'm somewhat blind to? Because it may just be that we've got a preference or an assumption and it needs to be laid open a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I want to keep it, man. I'm really enjoying this conversation, and I want to keep going down that road, but I want to hit a little bit more. And Curtis shared this really interesting crisis management studies Sunday.
Yeah.
So I want to give everyone a quick version of it. So the test involved bringing someone into a bathroom where a bathtub was quickly filling with water and the faucet was turned on. They were given three things, a teaspoon, a tablespoon, and a cup. And they were told that their job was to empty the tub of water as quickly as possible. Now, so what you have to do is, like, if I'm in that scenario, what do I do? Do I choose the teaspoon, the tablespoon, or the cup? And it seems obvious, given the options, grab the cup, start bailing water. But those who aren't overwhelmed by the moment, who sit back and think about it, there's a very small percentage of people, when presented with the situation, would stop and think, and then they would, instead of grabbing one of the three options, they would turn the water off and unplug the drain. Then they would grab the cup and start bailing water.
Brilliant. Brilliant.
So, you know, and what his point was is that when we focus on behavior and behavior modification, it's like grabbing a cup and trying to bail water out of a bathtub.
Mm-hmm.
It might be a short-term solution, but it doesn't bring about lasting change. What we need to do is turn off the water, unplug the drain, or stop simply addressing symptoms of the problem and get to the source of the problem.
Mm.
So, Patrick, when you heard that Sunday, or when you rehear it now, I'm like, can you connect this to any areas of your life? Can you think of a time you were cup scooping and get it instead of getting to the source?
Yes. One, I'd say this is a good plug for Christian counseling or therapy.
Absolutely.
Man, get to the source of stuff, you know, get under the surface. And there were so many examples. But this one, I felt like, wow, this is where the, you know, really shutting the water off made sense. One of the memories forever emblazoned in my mind was when Lindsay and I were engaged. I remember dropping her off at her house. I was living with a family in Savannah during our engagement, and she was at home, you know, still living at home. So I don't remember what led up to the conversation. I'd probably done something foolish, but we're standing there on her little front porch, and she looked at me and said, "If you can't be less negative, I don't know that I can marry you."
Woof.
And man, heck fire, when your fiance, you know, looks to you and says, "I don't know if this is going to happen," you're going to figure something out. Like, something's going to change. And so, you know, I immediately go into this modification mode, and I'm going to try really hard now to be more positive and less negative. You know, turn on Mr. Rogers mode, you know, Bob Ross, there's no mistakes, just happy accidents. I'm happy.
Yeah.
And you know, the willpower motivation lasts a solid day,
yeah,
maybe a week. And so it wasn't really producing lasting change. And honestly, like, for goodness, a decade,
yeah,
you know, that was just a struggle. But, now there's family of origin, characteristics that we all catch, and there was some negativity there. And so certainly that was part of it. But years later, I would discover the Enneagram, and, which, you know, in some circles, you're not allowed to talk about Enneagram. In other circles, it's like, yeah, the Enneagram and the Bible. So I totally see this as a resource, not a God. But with the Enneagram and counseling and my own study of that, so I'm an Enneagram type 6, which is a loyalist. I'm a golden retriever, you know, kind of guy. I will be with you through thick and thin as long as I feel like I can trust you.
Yeah.
And so there are wirings that we have. And one of my wirings is to just see the danger in things, the downsides of things. I'm a worst case scenario kind of thinker.
Yeah.
So if you lived in my mind for a day, you would be like, get some Prozac or like whatever you need to come down off it, brother. Because I'm just like, I'm driving down the road and I see every scenario and it plays out in full scope, you know? And so, if you're with, like, when we take the kids to Dollywood, I see what happens wrong, you know, what could happen wrong on every ride. So you want to be with me in a disaster because I've already thought through it and what we would need to do.
Mm-hmm.
But that's also just how I live. So I think there's some of that negativity, that comes out. And so part of what happens with Enneagram is every character type has, an underlying emotion,
yeah,
as well as an underlying need. My need is for security and safety. The underlying emotion is fear.
Yeah.
And so that can lead to me voicing negative thoughts at times. And, But as I started understanding, you know, part of my negativity is I'm kind of hedging bets.
Yeah.
Like if I expect you to let me down, or if I expect this scenario to go badly, then I can somehow make myself more secure.
Yeah.
And more in control. And so I have to start thinking, well, what does that look like for that command, you know, that Curtis brought up? Be joyful always.
Yeah.
Well, it's really hard to be joyful always if you're honestly looking at, like, here's everything that could go wrong. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even this morning, so I got a flat tire the other day, like just on a 5-minute drive from home.
Of course.
Which means 2 new tires, because I don't change one tire at a time. I just can't do it. throws off your car, people, you know. So I go visit, you know, our mechanic and do that. I have to get the oil change as well. That's a quick $350, you know, $350.
Adds up fast.
And so I call Lindsay. I'm like, well, I'm leaving, you know, and, you know, man, just feels like a punch to the gut. And Lindsay's like, well, you could be grateful that we have jobs and you have the money to pay for that. And I'm like, okay, you're right. You're right.
Starting to understand why
you're married. Yes. And I'm like, okay, yes, this can be framed, you know, in a more positive fashion. So just knowing myself and more self-awareness, again, the Enneagram is a great tool for spiritual formation, you know, because of that. But so is great company and good people around you who can challenge you. So that's where I'm like, okay, I had to get under the surface of like, it's not just about, I need to be more positive. I need to understand what's the driving force behind my negativity and my lack of joy and gratitude. So, that's a long-winded answer. But
no, that's a great, and I really appreciate your vulnerability in sharing that too. Cause you know, like all of us are messed up. And I think pastors in particular sometimes have this tendency to hide our faults and failures, which is not helpful for other people. Mm-hmm. I really do believe that. I also do believe the Enneagram is a fantastic source of self-reflection for a lot of people. I'm an Enneagram 9. I like peace, and boy, has it been a fun season to be a 9. But I won't, you know, self-indulge by going deep into that. But you know, like I recently learned that one of the Hebrew words for prayer, talitha, is all about, it's actually a form of prayer of self-reflection. So it's an ancient practice as a, mm-hmm. you know, not just a Christian, but as a Hebrew way back in the day, mm-hmm. to sit down and reflect on yourself. Yeah. Why is this going on? Why am I behaving this way? What has, you know, Megan and I, every time we come home from Christmas, it's like, do you do this because of this at your house?
Yeah.
but yeah, we won't get too far deep into that. I feel like that's going to be a theme in this podcast now is, okay, we could go down that road further, but instead we're going
to
keep on.
Yeah, listen to all the future shows.
So Curtis ended the sermon by reminding us all that God is the source of new life for us. And, you know, and he used a really neat illustration of you know, water in a cup and messy water and filling it and it overflowing. Mm-hmm. By the way, if you haven't for some reason watched the sermon, it is on YouTube. It's on Facebook. You can find it on our website, crossroadsgray.org. I would encourage you to go watch it. But Patrick, I was curious, you know, do you have any habits or practices in your life that help you connect to the source that maybe some of us can use to grow our faith?
Yeah, I mean, my everyday practices are scripture reading, you know, prayer, reflection, and journaling. So I'm always reading. For a while now, I've been reading like the proverb of the day. You know, since there's 31 proverbs, it tends to flow pretty well. And then I read a psalm because psalms teach us how to pray. Mm-hmm. And then I'm usually reading somewhere else in the New Testament. Again, right now I'm going through Hebrews. So, and then I reflect, you know, sometimes I will do, you know, Lectio Divina, like we talked about a couple weeks back, and really just try to go deeper into one setting mm-hmm. of a text. But the journaling for me is just, it's therapeutic. It is, it helps me pray, in a more focused manner. And so those are some practices. However, one of the things that I've been thinking more, about lately is the fact that I've never met a grateful follower of Jesus that I haven't admired.
Yeah.
Somebody who's truly grateful, They also tend to be truly humble.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm just thinking more on the lines of gratitude as a practice. And, you know, what would that look like if I practiced gratitude? If, you know, as a family, we practiced gratitude, what about as a church staff? What about as an eldership, the deacons? What about as a whole church? Mm-hmm. You know, if we were just a network of people and then in those different spheres of relationship who practiced gratitude, I just think about how transformative that would be within our communities and, mm-hmm. and our families and what that would do for our faith.
It's a very counter 2020 suggestion, Patrick.
Yeah. I mean, how easy to get on and, you know, on social media or whatever and harp on what's wrong or the things we don't like, or I don't like that Supreme Court, you know,
murder hornets,
nominee, or yeah, there's murder hornets that are, you know, killing the bears. I don't know. Like whatever it is, you know, like there was a story about how even fat bears are getting too fat. It's just like, come on, this is 2020. So, I really think, you know, a practice of gratitude, is going to be essential in our formation. And I look at my own children and think, man, where does that lack of gratitude come from? And then, like Curtis said, I've got to look right in the mirror and it's me. And I can be so ungrateful so fast and at the same time be judgmental of people who are not grateful
mm-hmm.
Because it's so much easier to see in other people. So I think that is a practice that really I'd like to focus on. And it also takes accountability, you know, mm-hmm. to do that and have people invited into, hey, call me out, you know, when you hear that.
What I love about what you suggested is that you suggested some practices there that I think are pretty universal. Mm-hmm. And then you honed in on something. And you said, this is me. This is what Patrick needs. And I think, you know, that's a part of that self-reflection and being self-aware. Being self-aware will help you pinpoint the things that you need to put into place and focus on. So that's, I think, a challenge for all of us, you know, as we continue this 167 series, as we continue to talk about what the Bible means for our lives and continue to find new resources and new ways to dig in and reflect, that we, you know, do those practices, but we also be self-aware, learn about ourselves and learn how the scriptures interact with our lives. So we are wrapping up here. It's been a really fast little 30 minutes here. I'm wondering if there's anything else you'd like to say before we hop off.
No, I mean, not in particular. Just again, thanks for the podcast and to everyone listening. You know, thank you all for your continued prayers for church leadership and your continued faithfulness in giving. You know, just that classic, don't grow weary in doing good. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a hard season for everyone. And, you know, we've got to support each other as the body. So thank you, everybody.
Absolutely. Hey, we'd have a few different ways for you to connect with us after today. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram by searching Crossroads Christian. You can also find our YouTube channel, which has a plethora of different options for kids and students and adults. We have some in-person studies happening now outside safely, like the Thursday group that meets at 7 p.m. Is that right?
That's right.
And all kinds of other options. So we really like to encourage you to get connected. And more than anything, make the most of the rest of your 167 hours. Have a great week.